Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, Meg 2, The Trench, The Beanie Bubble, and a look back at Big Top Pee Wee and Escape from New York. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a new 4K of Nightbreed. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Barbie continued to dominate over last weekend. It made $93 million in its second outing. That's higher than what Top Gun Maverick did last summer. From a day-to-day perspective, Barbie is beating Top Gun Maverick. Now, is it going to end up beating the number? Maybe? I don't know. You never know with something like this. It's holding extremely well. It only dropped 42% from its opening weekend, which is an incredible hold. So it certainly seems to have some very good legs. Same thing with Oppenheimer. It came in with $47 million, and it only dropped 43%. The difference, I think, between Barbie and Top Gun Maverick when we look at the whole picture is Top Gun Maverick came out earlier in the summer, and it benefited from an entire summer of movie watching. Barbie just has kind of until the end of August. But the thing is, the thing that's going to help Barbie is there's no other huge competition coming up. There's no other massive movie, as opposed to when Top Gun Maverick dropped. It dropped in the middle of a very crowded summer marketplace. So it is very likely that Barbie could at least do Top Gun Maverick numbers, if not even beat it. The next piece of news I want to talk about is a sad piece of news. Of course, I have to say rest in peace to Paul Reubens. He is better known as Pee-wee Herman. I'm going to be talking about a Pee-wee Herman movie this week. I might cover one in the next week or two. I always thought Pee-wee Herman was done dirty by people. He had a little kerfuffle where he was in an adult movie theater and got arrested. And I think what harmed his image the most is because he ostensibly did a kid's show, Pee-wee's Playhouse. I wouldn't say that the movies were necessarily kids' movies, although they played to kids well. The character of Pee-wee Herman seemed to be made to evoke a feeling of childlike nostalgia in people, and that's why he was sort of like this man-child. But apparently Paul Reubens had cancer, and he had for 6 years and had kept it quiet and didn't let anybody know. He passed away at 70, which is sad. He had done another Pee-wee Herman movie on Netflix a couple of years ago. I didn't even realize it was there, so I'm going to check that one out. And it was neat to see him show up in a bunch of stuff. He did revitalize his career a little bit, which is good because, you know, it was for one stupid mistake. Look, where he was doing what he was doing, who cares? Back then, if you were going to a movie theater for that, that's what you were doing. It wasn't like out on the street. You weren't doing it on a bus or anything like that. So I always felt bad for Pee-wee Herman just because it was just a bad situation. And it was before the internet. So, I mean, he could have avoided it 10 years later. But yes, he will be missed. And it's sad that he passed away. The next piece of news I want to talk about, more or less a request. I've gotten a couple requests asking whether I was going to review The Sound of Freedom. And right now I'm not. And here's why. It has nothing to do with politics. It's just I was out of town when it came out. I was on vacation. Disney had screened Indiana Jones, so I was able to do that and package a show early for that. But if anyone was listening to this on the radio, there was a best of show the week after, which is when Sound of Freedom opened. And I don't know if they did any regional screenings, but by the time I got home, it had kind of made its big splash and it continued to do well. It's been in the news, but at this point, I just don't see a place to fit it in. There's a lot of movies I haven't seen that are out. I mean, I've never seen Insidious: The Red Door. That was out while I was on vacation. I did not see No Hard Feelings. There's a couple other ones in the movie theater. So nothing against The Sound of Freedom. I'll probably cover it when it comes to video. When it comes time for it to do a home video release, I'll probably review it. Also, because I want to get outside of the political thing. You can't untangle this film from politics at this point because it's become a political rallying cry. And the problem is there's all these things that are like tangled up with it, QAnon conspiracies and questionable things that have happened by the organization that it represents and the guy it's about and whether or not that's accurate. And then I think the pay it forward thing is interesting, but I think that's a whole nother conversation to have as well, because while I'm like, you know, hey, whatever it takes to sell your movie, good for you. But on the other hand, I don't know how real popular this is because anybody can buy tickets. By the way, that's what they do with published books. If any politician publishes a book, people don't buy it. It's not, I mean, like, you know, if a president publishes a book, people are going to read it. But a lot of these low-level politicians, they publish books. And then what happens is these groups will then go buy multiple copies of the book. And it's a way to boost sales and make it look good. But it's really not an authentic buy. People aren't really interested in Dick Ebhardt's biography. It's just when he published his biography, there were people who went and bought the book because they wanted to support him as a political action thing. You know, that happens with all politicians on both sides of the aisle. And I also don't know, there's never been any sort of accounting. There's no transparency about one-to-one ticket sales. So I want to get outside of that before I review the movie. I'll watch it on video and then we can maybe talk about it outside of all the extraneous hubbub. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is coming out in September. It is Saw 10 or Saw X, and it releases on September 29th.
According to these scans, the tumor was never removed.
How much time do I have?
Months, at best.
I still have a lot of work that needs to be done.
Hello, everyone. It's time to play a game. You all pretended to cure me, but what I have planned for each of you is very real.
There was a time when the tagline for Saw movies were, if it's Halloween, it's time for Saw. If you recall it, when the first one came out, gosh, almost 20 years ago, they released a new Saw movie every year at Halloween. And then finally, when that kind of died down a bit, they had the Paranormal Activity movies that released every year at Halloween. It basically killed 10 years of October releases. It took years for people to put anything that would go up against Saw or Paranormal Activity. Well, now they're trying to bring it back in the October timeframe, and they're dropping it at the end of September. I don't know. This looks interesting. I like Tobin Bell. I like the return of Tobin Bell, kind of making it a bit of a prequel to what goes on. So I'm curious. I understand that these are unpleasant movies and they're grisly, but I think at least the earlier ones had a weird moral compass to it that I thought was an interesting take on the situation. The next trailer I want to play is for Loki Season 2, which comes to Disney Plus on October 6th.
I've been pulled through time between the past and the present.
Hello?
If what I saw is true, there's nothing to stand between this world and utter destruction.
Only one way to find out.
It's up to us to save this place.
Whatever we do, we're playing God.
I'm really looking forward to this because I really loved the first Loki series. I love that heady metaphysical stuff that I'm a huge fan of it. And that's why I like seeing these Marvel movies and where they go. I don't care whether they're goofy and silly like Thor, Love and Thunder, or action oriented like the Multiverse of Madness, or even like Quantumania. I like just because it was so out there. And I'm looking forward to more of that with Loki Season 2. It's interesting because Jonathan Majors is in the trailer. We're still having yet to see what's going to happen with him and his relationship with Disney. I heard his trial in New York has been postponed. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Beanie Bubble and Meg 2, The Trench.
We'll be right back.
back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. It's time to jump into the movie reviews. The first one I want to talk about is The Beanie Bubble. This is on Apple TV+. The real story of the rise and fall of the Beanie Baby Empire is told in this docudrama.
We broke the entire internet thing. You go big or you go home.
Ty would tell you he did it all. Which is as crazy as believing stuffed animals are gold.
Did you see the truck crash?
Insane.
Poor beanies.
This has always been my company.
Company we created.
We have had a rash of movies this year in particular that are about the development of some corporate product. Whether it's Air Jordans with Air or Tetris from Nintendo or Beanie Babies with the Beanie Bubbles. You've got Flaming Hot with the Flaming Hot Cheetos. BlackBerry was another one, you know, the development of the BlackBerry. While some of these movies are good, it's kind of overkill at this point. I'm just like, oh my gosh, how many more stories of how a product was made movies are we going to get? I mean, you always had those movies showing up now and then, but we just rattled off five in the last 6 months. That's an absurd number of these kind of movies. But I figured it was worth, I might as well give this one a shot. Also, because I was very curious to see Zach Galifianakis in this movie, because he plays Ty Warner, who is the founder of the Beanie Baby Empire. I mean, he doesn't have his beard. He shaved off his beard, and he's got kind of this goofy hairdo and these glasses. He kind of looks basically like John Goodman from The Righteous Gemstones. I mean, there's like literal shots where I could believe it was John Goodman from The Righteous Gemstones in that shot. But actually, he does a really good job. It's interesting because Zach Galifianakis came on and playing that very Zach Galifianakis role that he got famous for with The Hangover. And he at times has really tried to kind of break out of that. He's tried to do more dramatic stuff, and that's never really caught on. He's tried to do some different things. He did that movie, The Campaign, which coincided, I think, with the campaign between Obama and Romney. So like 2012, that's how old that movie is. But he shaved off his beard, he kept his mustache, and he's tried to break out of his typical Zach Galifianakis role, and he never really can. And I think maybe he's an okay actor, but he's not a brilliant actor, but he's really good at that shtick. But this gives him a chance to stretch his legs, and you've got some pretty good names involved in this. I mean, obviously, you've got Elizabeth Banks in there, and Sarah Snook from Succession is in there. There's also Geraldine Viswanathan. I've seen her in several things. The one thing I know her from most is Miracle Workers. She's actually got a really good wit. She's a very good comedian, so she's good in the movie, and it's neat seeing the different actors in there, but it's also ultimately it's a story of the rise and fall of the Beanie Baby, the bubble that was created. It's basically Tulip Fever. If you look back at Beanie Babies, it's very clear that that's what happened with it. It was a fad. And this character of Ty Warner, the real guy, and he kind of just lucked into it. And what's funny is one of the things they point out in the movie is the Beanie Babies benefited a lot from the internet. They were the first company that actually did a direct-to-consumer website, and they used data from eBay because of the secondary market selling. But they neglected to mention that the internet was also critical to its bust, because the internet can destroy collectability by revealing true rarities. Like, I have a comic book collection. I remember back in the 80s, if you wanted a comic book, you wanted like Superboy 76 or something like that, you had to go look every single comic shop, and you had to go to comic book shows and go to comic book stuff. You could only do so much. I mean, yeah, you could get these magazines that you can order from, but it was very hard to track down just a specific issue, especially if it wasn't like Action Comics number 1 or Detective Comics number, 27, which is the first one that had Batman. Those everybody knows, but if it's just a random one that you're trying to fill a slot in your comic book collection, they're very hard to find. Once the internet came around, you could buy it from anywhere. And that's what happened with Beanie Babies, is there were certain things that also had regional rarities that you couldn't find in the Midwest, but you could find in the Southwest. And second, the internet was available to go back and forth, that could burst the bubble. I mean, the movie itself is okay. It's an interesting framing device because it plays in multiple eras and multiple decades, which makes it a little bit confusing. The biggest issue is, I mean, this Ty Warner character seems like kind of a sleazebag, and they play him as like, oh, we didn't realize he was a sleazebag. My experience with sleazebags, and trust me, I've known a lot of sleazebags in my life. My experience with sleazebags is you get warning signs all the time, and people just are glad to ignore them, and that was my biggest thing. I mean, the movie itself was okay, but it really struggled to try and force the point. I don't know. I mean, in the end, some good performances helped buoy up the lesser installment in the corporate innovator biopics that have flooded the market recently. But still, I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Meg 2, The Trench. A group of explorers dive to a trench at the bottom of the ocean and unleash a group of megalodons onto the surface.
We're detecting increased aquatic activity 25,000 feet deep in the trench. It's an ancient ecosystem untouched by man. Whatever is down there is trying to make its way to the surface. This was a bad idea.
Just a little bit.
That's the biggest Meg I've ever seen.
Biggest Meg anyone's ever seen.
That's the apex predator.
Look, I thought the first movie, The Meg, was kind of fun. I mean, it was stupid, and you know, it was really a throwaway movie when you get down to it. But it was fun. I mean, Jason Statham fighting a shark, sure, why not? This sequel, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but it's terrible. It is not a good movie. It's not an action movie. I mean, it tries to be so many different things. It tries to be an action movie. It tries to be almost a send-up of it. It feels like it's made for a Chinese market because there's whole scenes that have the character. They have characters that are Chinese because that's the rich people who are running the research vessel. And they have whole scenes of them talking and sort of like if you've seen enough movies made for the Chinese market, it kind of feels kind of like the pacing and the dialogue, not the dialogue itself, but sort of like the structure and how it's put together. It feels like some of these bigger action movies I've seen from China, and I don't know if this is going to click necessarily with a mainstream American audience because those scenes just kind of seem out of nowhere, and also the effects are terrible. Because you can do CGI doesn't mean you should. I mean, they're giant sharks, and obviously you need to do CGI, but I did a giant shark movie a couple months ago, and I would say that the special effects are marginally about the same. And then, like, it's broken up, like, it has this whole section where they're down in the bottom of this trench, and then there's these people who are doing bad things down there, and then they're like, oh, gotta worry about the Megs. So the Megs are swimming up. The Megs are 100 feet long, and you're a size of a peanut to them. Why are they worried about you? Then, of course, you have to have them attacking a beach, which just seems thrown in. I mean, it's forced. It has these weird moments where it really tries to be sincere and just doesn't click. And all the stuff at the bottom of the ocean is dark and murky, and that's the bottom of the ocean. But, you know, gosh, I couldn't see anything. I couldn't tell what half of what was going on. I mean, dark and murky and nonsensical. This tepid sequel fails to work as an action movie, as a shark movie, or a send-up of either one. Meg 2 sucks.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, and Big Top Pee-wee. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem. Four Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, who live in the sewers of New York City, help a high school journalist uncover a plot to have the mutants take over the world.
Wait, did you hear that? What was that?
Well, nothing we can do. You guys want to grab pizza?
Can I kick it? What the heck are those things?
They look like little Shreks to me.
So, you were baby turtles who made contact with mystery goo.
Well, we prefer the term ooze, but yeah.
It's like more like, it's just nicer.
It rolls off the tongue better, yeah.
Ooze. It's nice, right?
It's ooze.
I was just a little bit too old to be a big fan of the Turtles back when they came out. It was sort of like where I fell in relation to Goonies. Goonies is a movie that a lot of kids that were a little bit younger than me, less than 10 years, were huge fans of because they were like 10 and 11 when it came out on HBO and it got played a lot and they watched it and it became this phenomenon for the generation that's just behind me. And that's the way the Turtles were. I mean, I had a friend and his brother who was 7 or 8 years younger than him was totally into the Turtles. I mean, he was the perfect age for it. But I can understand the fandom to it, and I understand they're enduring because they've been around for 40-some years. And I respect that. I've seen all the movies. This is like their 7th film, and they did 3 live-action films. The first one was decent in the 1990, and the second one was okay, and the third one was awful. And then they did the animated TMNT in 2007, which is probably one of the best ones they did, because it lends itself to full CGI animation, and that's what works in this movie, too. Then they did those 2 live-action CGI hybrids that were kind of a mess in 2014, 2016. Now, this one, they kind of go back to their roots, and they do update them to be modern teenagers. I mean, they're on smartphones, for example. I don't know who's paying the phone bills. I don't know if Splinter walked into AT&T and got some Apple phones for all the kids, because, of course, if there were teenagers back when they first came out, they'd be middle-aged now. But they're still teenagers, and one of the best things about this film is the voice cast, because they actually get kids or actors that either are or sound like teenagers to do their voices. You don't have some guy in their late 20s or early 30s doing the voice and pretending to be goofy and being a cartoon character. They sound like teenagers, which kind of makes it work. And that's actually what gives it a real heart, because they're not just forcing big name voices into the movie. I mean, they do have them in there, but just not in those characters. And their rapport with April O'Neil, and they kind of update her character a little bit, and she's kind of a nerd, and I like what they did with that. They go really big with this one, and the animation is innovative. I mean, it's similar to the kind of animation you saw in Across the Spider-Verse, but it has its own trend to it. It's kind of has that neon color, and it has a murky shot in the sewers kind of look to it, which lends itself to the movie. And it's quite well done. I mean, it's beautifully animated. It's got a great voice cast in a lot of, secondary roles, a lot of big names in there. Like you got Seth Rogen helped write it and produce it, but he also plays, he plays Rocksteady or Bebop. I forget which. I get him mixed up. And I think John Cena plays the other one. So you've got some great names behind it, and it's a fun show. But it is just a big version of the comic books. It's like an episode of the cartoon, only much, much bigger and louder and made for the big screen. But that's okay, because if this is made for kids, this is a toy movie, and it's not gonna make as much money as Barbie, but it's a fun movie, and it has the heart and sweetness that you'd expect from the Turtles. The design is innovative, and the nostalgia factor is off the charts, but it still plays like a huge episode of the classic cartoon. I'm going to still say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. As promised, I want to talk about Big Top Pee-wee. This is a Pee-wee Herman movie in honor of Paul Reubens. I could have gone back and watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but I'd seen that a bunch of times. And I'd only seen Big Top Pee-wee once. I never saw it in the theaters. I ended up seeing it on VHS, like, in the late 80s or early 90s. I forget when. Just a year or two after it came out. And I remember not being impressed, but also totally being in love with Valeria Galino, who goes on to be in well-known movies like Rain Man and Hot Shots. She's beautiful. And this is her first American role, I believe, or at least American starring role. But anyways, let's play the trailer. Quirky and childlike Pee-wee Herman lends his farm to a struggling circus and falls in love with the girl on the flying trapeze.
Hello!
Welcome to the set of my cool new Paramount motion picture.
Guess what it's about?
This film's got everything. Thrills.
Chills. Romance.
That's right. It's the sexy love story between me and not one, but count them two beautiful women. It's also a buddy picture. Hey, there's one of my co-stars, Vance the Talking Pig. Say something, Vance.
There's some very Pee-wee Herman moments in this, like similar to Pee-wee's Big Adventure when he wakes up in the morning and he does all the stuff in his house and he's got these Rube Goldberg devices. That's they try to do that. But here's the thing. Tim Burton with that first movie was so innovative and so fresh with his style. I mean, now we recognize it, but you know, back in the 80s, nobody knew who Tim Burton was. It was brilliant, and it was very high energy and creative and bizarre, but also very alluring. Randall Kleiser, who's best known for doing Grease, I believe, is one of his other credits. He directed Grease. He grounds it a little bit more, so it's less. I mean, it's still bizarre because you know, like Pee Wee Herman goes out to the barn and the barn animals are in beds covered up with blankets, and they have to make their beds and they help make breakfast. So, I mean, it still has the silliness to it and the childlike element to it, but it just doesn't seem as insane. It doesn't seem as cotton candy. It seems like it's these bizarre elements dropped into a pragmatic setting as opposed to the entire setting being bizarre, which is what his house was. And they also have this pig that talks. I think his name's Lance or something like that. But it almost feels like the pig didn't have lines initially, that Pee-wee Herman was supposed to talk to him, and then they added lines looping it later, and they changed it. Because there's a lot of scenes where you're like, you know what? If the pig didn't speak, it would still work. And I think it was a mistake to have the pig speak, because part of it is you want Pee-wee Herman to just be insane, and everything he touches is insane. But everybody else is kind of lives in the normal world. And it doesn't have as much scope. I mean, it is just the story of him having this farm and helping these circus performers put on their show. And the townspeople don't want the circus performers in there. I don't know, because they're weird. I mean, they're going to bring money to the town. I never quite understood why the townsfolk don't like the circus, but they don't. And that's a big deal for them. But it has that element to it, but it doesn't have much more to the story. It just sort of presents silliness, but even then the silliness, it's not as silly as it needs to be. It's because you suddenly put people in a circus atmosphere and you already have this sense of heightened reality where you have the sideshow workers and the people, you have little people and you have giants and you have the bearded lady and you've got the guy, the half man, half woman, and I have all that stuff. So you already are living in a hyper real environment. And so Pee-wee Herman just kind of blends in, and he's not crazy. And that's, I think, kind of what's a bit jarring to it. And then it does try to lean on this love story, which is not great. But like I said, I still was and am a fan of Valeria Galeno. I've always kind of had a thing for her. So it's lacking in the energy and the off-kilter consistency from the first film, but the sequel does manage to have a few fun moments. But unfortunately, as a whole, comparing it to the first one, for sure, it kind of sucks. Hopefully, when I watch the next one, it'll be better.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Escape from New York and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Nightbreed. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and take a look back at one, a vintage release. And that is Escape from New York. I have a friend, a film critic from Columbus who does radio down here, and his name's John DeSando, and he's on WCBE in Columbus. And he occasionally has me come on the show and talk about a new release or for his show Cinema Classics, we talked to about a classic. And he hit me up and said, hey, let's talk about Escape from New York, and it's on Amazon Prime. Well, it's not on Amazon Prime, it's on Freevee. Freevee is basically the free service of Amazon. You get the stuff with ads in it, so they embed a whole slew of ads. So it's like watching Tubi or Roku TV or something like that. I said, yeah, sure. I've seen Escape from New York several times, but I went ahead and I rewatched it, and it gave me a reason to look back at a lot of John Carpenter's stuff. And this is one of these linchpins in his incredible run from 1978 to 1988. But let's talk about it. John Carpenter directs this science fiction flick about a criminal sent to the prison complex of ruined New York City to rescue the president.
The crime rate in the United States rises 400%. 1991, the United States Police Force is formed. 1997, New York City is a walled maximum security prison. John Carpenter's Escape from New York.
Now, you notice I didn't call it an action movie, because Escape from New York's not really an action movie. A lot of people label it that way. But you got to understand, Carpenter was not an action director. I don't think he had the budget to do a full-blown action movie. It starts out as an action movie, and it starts out with a lot of special effects. I mean, the movie starts out with helicopters and limousines, and it's got a plane crash, and it's got gunfire and everything, and this sort of dystopian police station set design. And then they send Snake Plissken, played by Kurt Russell, to New York, and when he gets into New York, it just kind of turns into a gritty drama. I mean, it has action scenes in it, but he doesn't make an action movie until he does Escape from LA, like, what, 15 years later in the 90s. That one's definitely much more of an action movie. This one's a slower burn. And that's the reality of Carpenter. I mean, you go back and look at something like The Fog, that one's also a slow burn as well. I mean, some of his movies, like The Thing and Halloween, they have an energy to them, then they move fast. But Escape from New York is leaner, and it's grittier, and it's not my favorite. I would say of all the movies in that run, that 10-year run, I mean, from, like, if you count, this is one of the best runs in cinema history for any director anywhere. I mean, you've got Halloween in 1978. You've got The Fog in 1980. You've got Escape from New York in 1981. The Thing in 1982. Christine in 1983. And a lot of people malign Christine. I've gone back and watched it, and I think it's a decent movie. It's still not the least Carpenter for me at that time. And then he does, like, Starman in 1985, and I think Big Trouble in Little China in 1986, Prince of Darkness 1987, and then They Live in 1988. In that 10-year period, they're all bangers. They're all great movies. And even though I'm not a huge fan of Escape from New York, I think it shows Carpenter playing around with certain ideas. And, you know, you see some of the themes leaking into, obviously, Escape from LA, but even stuff like They Live, you see that showing up again in They Live. And he plays around a lot with his own political views and his view of totalitarianism. And of course, this being in 1981, Carpenter's always been super far left liberal. This is him reacting to Reagan's America. And I'm not going to make a judgment on the politics of it. It's just, it really gives you an idea of where Carpenter's coming from. And this is a neat movie, but like I said, it is a slow burn. It is not really an action movie. For as much gunplay and explosions as they have, it's not. But it's definitely worth checking out if you've never seen Escape from New York. And I like Escape from LA. I'm one of those few people who like Escape from LA, because it has some bad special effects, but yeah, it's okay. That was the 90s. Late 90s was replete with terrible effects. Not my favorite classic Carpenter film, but it still offers a scrappy look at the director's political edge. I'm going to say Escape from New York kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on the new 4K of Nightbreed, which comes to us courtesy of Shout Factory, or Scream Factory, since this is a horror movie. I'm going to play the trailer. I'm going to talk about the movie really quickly, and then there's a lot I got to say about the Blu-ray and the 4K and physical media and the different versions of it. So Clive Barker directs this twisted tale of a troubled man seeking a hidden city where the monsters live.
Who's buried in Midian?
Ain't nothing but dead folk.
Somewhere
hidden from sight, is a place that's not on any map. Midian.
Something's breeding there.
They call it home.
There goes the neighborhood.
They're not even human. But this time, they're the good guys.
This was his follow-up, Clive Barker's follow-up, to Hellraiser, which the horror world was blown away by Hellraiser. And I thought that was good. And then you had the 1-2 punch of Hellraiser and then the sequel, Hellbound, which I think is just as good, if not better, because it so expands the Cenobite universe. And then they started doing stuff like Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, and just a whole sling of just awful direct-to-video stuff. But those first two are fantastic, and even though Clive Barker didn't direct the second one, he directed the first, and the second one really feels like it has his fingerprints on it. And then he did Nightbreed in 1990. And I remember seeing it in the theater and was really interested in it. I mean, it's kind of a bonkers movie because it has some insane stuff going on. It has very gory special effects. The character of Aaron Boone, Craig Sheffer plays him. I don't think he's that good. Anne Bobby plays his girlfriend, and she's sort of miscast in this. But they're committed, and they do a good job. But it's so bizarre with the misfit monsters in there. There's also been a lot of talk about the fact that, you know, Clive Barker's, he's a gay man and he's been openly gay for years. And a lot of people talk about this as a point in queer cinema where it addresses the people who are persecuted throughout the years, especially by religious organizations, and the people who just want to kind of live a quiet life, even if they're a little weird. And Barker struggled against the studio in making a movie that put the monsters as the good guys. So it's well done. It sometimes gets really inconsistent because at one point it's like a slasher movie, and at another point it's an action movie, and then another point it's kind of this subversive, almost dark comedy. It does shift tones a lot, but I really enjoy the movie, especially if you like the creature features and some really out there designs. It also has David Cronenberg playing a serial killer, and he's fantastic. And I wish Cronenberg did more acting. You can see him on Star Trek Discovery now, but, you know, I wish he did more acting, especially when he was younger. So one of the reasons to get this, and one of the reasons I love Shout Factory, is they believe in physical media. And physical media is important because with the streaming now, sometimes they'll just take stuff off a service and they have no reason to keep it on there. Now, maybe if you've bought it, you have a little bit more of a right to it, but you still don't. In particular, the 4K is the original theatrical cut, which, by the way, was very hard to get for many, many years. It started out as a theatrical cut. That was the only one. And then Clive Barker had the director's cut, or the cabal cut, that he wanted to do that included a lot more elements to it, and they have the director's cut available on one of the Blu-rays and the theatrical cut. But I wanted to show it to my kids for a horror marathon we were doing a couple years ago, and I had to track down an old DVD to get the original theatrical cut. That's one of the great things. You can't find the theatrical cut on streaming. Everywhere it's streaming, it's the director's cut. And I know that's what Clive Barker wants, but I like the theatrical cut better. And now nobody can take away my theatrical cut because I've got a copy of it sitting on my bookshelf. And that's why you get physical media. And then on top of it, Shout Factory just loads it up. I mean, there's commentaries on both the different versions of the film. There's 4 discs to this thing. They've got an entire Blu-ray bonus disc, and it's all background stuff. It's featurettes and behind the scenes and test footage and rehearsals. It's a whole package. And if you're at all a fan of Nightbreed, this is the thing to get. You don't get the full cabal cut, the 2.5-hour version, but you get the director's cut, and it's been blessed by Clive Barker, even says so on the disc. So, look, this is visionary and weird, though uneven at times. It's classic Clive Barker finding a place in the heart for the misfits. Nightbreed totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be coming back to talk about The Last Voyage of the Demeter and Jules. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.